Hello, and welcome to Advisory Explained. I'm your host, Kwesi Kretzinger. Join me in this series, this podcast where we discuss the complex world of advisory. We dive deep into very specific topics in the world of mergers and acquisitions, due diligence, tax, fiduciary services, and so much more, where we take complex topics and we break them down into smaller, bite-sized, palatable portions for you to understand and to understand where we can assist you. Hello and welcome to another episode of Advisory Explained. Today, we've got a special guest, Bobby Wessels from AJM Tax, and we are going to discuss anti-avoidance, specifically the special rules in anti-avoidance. We're going to look at two very specific rules today. Paragraph 43A in the 8th schedule and Section 8E in the Income Tax Act. Bobby, welcome.
Thank you very much, Kwesi.
Before we get started, let's just do an introduction. So, who are you? Where do you come from? I know you are at AJM Tax. So, yeah.
Yes, because as you mentioned, I work at AJM Tax. I started there straight out of varsity. Mm-hmm. You know, I studied BCLB at Stellenbosch University, graduated, and then after that went straight into the tax world. I think the degree sort of lends itself nicely to a bit of law and accounting knowledge. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I've been there since. It's now almost 6 years that I've been at AJM Tax. And I work in the corporate and international sort of transactions department. Mm-hmm. And deal with most of those matters on a daily basis.
Oh, fantastic. And AJM in a general, so just for the listeners, what do you guys do? What's your full scope of services?
We're a specialist tax firm that looks at anything. I always say to clients, the best way to describe it is anything and everything. Mm-hmm. With tax, from, you know, tax returns to complex tax structures. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say tax structures, any structures as a whole. They ultimately always have some form of a tax angle involved.
Absolutely.
So yeah, anything that sort of involves the tax, both locally and internationally, is primarily what we do.
Oh, that's fantastic. In terms of the two specific anti-avoidance rules that we're going to touch on today, paragraph 43A of the 8th schedule and section 8E, hybrid equity instruments, why are these two very specific ones for you specifically?
So I think both of them try to target specific transactions. Mm-hmm. And sort of places where it's in the name, anti-avoidance has creeped up, and where people have devised clever ways to utilize tax mm-hmm. legislation to essentially ensure that there's significant tax benefits to affecting certain transactions in a certain manner. They're quite different, but they both target essentially at the end of the day dividends.
Yeah.
And the reason it does that is because for most part between companies in South Africa, dividends is exempt, both from an income tax perspective and from a dividends tax perspective. And so the holy grail of trying to structure a transaction from a tax perspective is to see how you can use that how that can be used to your advantage. And that's what taxpayers have done over time and why these two anti-avoidance provisions have sort of arisen.
Okay, fantastic. In terms of paragraph 43A, so obviously I know what it is, I know where it comes from, etc. But in layman's terms, in easy understanding terms, how would you describe paragraph 43A? What is it?
Well, I think the colloquial way describes it, the colloquial name describes it quite well. It's dividend stripping.
Yeah.
And essentially what it involves is where you effectively strip all the value out of a company through a tax neutral dividend.
Yeah.
So as I mentioned to you earlier, you know, dividends is exempt between companies, both from income tax and dividends tax perspective. So you have a company, let's say it's got 100 million rand in value, and its shareholder is another company, and you declare all the value from the target company, 100 million rand, you declare all that value as a dividend to its shareholder, and then following that transaction, you effectively sell the company for 1 rand.
Yeah.
And you don't have any capital gains tax at that point because your capital gains triggers based on 1 rand.
And that was the ordinary way of doing a deal for a lot of companies before dividend stripping came into about.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, then obviously as the legislation, same with 8E, it evolves and
absolutely
gets better, so to speak.
Yeah, okay, fantastic. In terms of paragraph 43A, dividend stripping, as you mentioned, how does the legislation actually work? So what's the thought process to determine, am I in the ambit of paragraph 43A or not?
Effectively, there's a few building blocks that you sort of need to tick before you fall within paragraph 43 cap A. The first is that you need to have received an exempt dividend, so one that's exempt both for income tax purposes and for dividends tax purposes. The second is that you need to have what is known as a qualifying interest. Now, qualifying interest looks at the level of shareholding effectively that you have in the company. You can imagine if there's a shareholder that owns, for example, 10%, and they receive a dividend from the company, and then all of a sudden thereafter there's a transaction for them to do where they sell some of the shares. The intention isn't necessarily to capture that minority shareholder, so to speak. It's to capture people that have some form of control over the company. And so you need to have a qualifying interest, and it gets quite complex sometimes on what a qualifying interest means. But in layman's terms and simple terms, it's if you have more than 50% of the company, alone or together with a connected person, you'll have a qualifying interest. Or if there's nobody that owns more than 50% and you hold more than 20%.
Yeah. But
those are the two essential building blocks. And if you fall within those and you have a disposal, so in other words, you receive an exempt dividend, you have a qualifying interest, and then there's some form of a disposal. Then the next test, sort of the calculation test, is to see, well, did you receive what's known as an extraordinary dividend? And effectively what an extraordinary dividend is to say, well, if you received a dividend in excess of 15% of the market value of the company, we'll classify that portion, the portion that's in excess of
15%,
we'll classify that as an extraordinary dividend. The policy decision behind that is quite smart, I think, is to say that, to make it clear, the qualifying interest requirement and the extraordinary dividend needs to be within the last 18 months.
Okay.
So the policy behind that is actually quite clever. Treasury, I think, realizes, you know, that the intention isn't to capture all dividends. To capture this type of specific dividend that sort of extrapolates a lot of value.
The dividend strip.
Exactly.
That dividend.
Exactly. It's to capture that dividend. So in the ordinary course, so Treasury goes and puts a sort of indicator on it and say, well, in the ordinary course of a company's lifetime, we'd expect that they could declare, you know, 15% of their value in dividends over an 18-month period. Mm. And so where that happens, and then a company sells their shares, the intention isn't for us to capture those exempt dividends as a capital gain, so to speak.
Okay, fantastic. If we look at your example of a 100 million rand company declaring out a dividend and then selling the shares, what would be the effect for the shareholders at the end of the day?
Effectively, what happens is that portion that is termed the extraordinary dividend gets classified in that specific scenario to be proceeds for those shareholders.
So that's the 85% essentially.
Effectively, yeah. So let's take it in that example and let's assume there was no other dividends declared in the last 18 months. The 85 million of that 100 million will become proceeds for the shareholder, and which then will be utilized to calculate their capital gain exposure effectively.
And you spoke about 18 months in the last in the preceding period. My understanding is that dividend stripping is also looking forward to a certain extent, but it's not necessarily a timing thing. It's more in relation to a connected thing if the dividend is connected to a disposal.
Yeah, exactly. So effectively, there are two sort of triggers to see whether there's whether you fall within paragraph 43 cap A on that basis. The one is you held a qualifying interest in the last 18 months. The other one, where you received that exempt dividend in the last 8 months, the other one is you received that exempt dividend in respect by reason as a consequence of the disposal. Now, that's the one that you're referring to.
Exactly.
Causal type.
Yes.
If you go and look at the history behind it, one of the main reasons why that wording was introduced was to capture buybacks themselves.
Mm.
So a buyback itself is this weird anomaly where you basically have a dividend that precedes a sale, but that it all happens in one, as part of one transaction. It's not as distinct as the transaction that we put out earlier, 100 million rand dividend and then a sale. It's effectively in one transaction.
Yeah.
So that in respect by reason or consequence of was primarily introduced to capture that. But those words are so wide that there's a potential that even if you fall outside of this 18-month period, that you could potentially be caught by that. Now, has it been tested by our courts yet, any of the things we've spoken about as far as paragraph 3 cap A is concerned? But, you know, I think sort of there's certainly a risk that dividends that are causally connected to some form of disposal, even if they fall outside the 18-month period, can still be caught by paragraph 43 KPA.
Okay, fantastic. That's a very important thing that I've realized, especially in our side with restructurings and M&A transactions, is to have all parties alert specifically about that by reason of or in consequence of, because people miss that. They read the 18 months in the last or the 18-month period and say, listen, we haven't declared a dividend, so we're fine. But the fact is, you still have to look, is there a causal link between your dividend and the disposal at the end of the day?
Exactly. And it happens oftentimes that people say, oh, you know, we'll just wait 18 months in one day.
Mm.
I think the moment that that's the position that you leave with, you start with this, okay, this dividend is going to be caught by paragraph 43 cap. Let's just wait out the 18 months. Then you start connecting it yourself.
Exactly.
To the disposal.
Yeah.
I think that creates the inherent issue. The other part, obviously, is that 43 cap is the one that we deal with most of the time.
Mm.
But the Income Tax Act has a copycat of 43 cap that applies in cases where shares are held as trading stock.
Mm.
So 43 cap applying in cases where shares are held as... Exactly.
Mm.
Exactly. Yeah. But there's a provision in the Income Tax Act similarly deals with.
Yeah, 22B.
Exactly.
Yeah. In the example of subscription, so me and you, we shareholders in a company, and for instance, we both 50% shareholders. Now our friend, Villalem, for argument's sake, wants to subscribe also into our company. So we decide, okay, the value is 100 million, we 50 million each, we're going to declare a dividend of 50 million. 25 to your company, 25 to my company, and then the price is technically cheaper, so it's not necessarily a sale, it's a subscription. Would that also be caught in paragraph 43A?
It certainly does. And again, provided those requirements are met, but in that scenario, it sounds like all those, you know, requirements are going to be met, which takes you then to paragraph 43 cap A4, subsection. And what that one deals with specifically is to say, in instances where there is a subscription that results in the change in the value of the equity shares. Mm. So in our scenario, you know, our value decreases as a result of Wilhelm's subscription.
Yeah.
That is seen as a disposal.
Yeah.
The unfortunate thing about that transaction is that for purposes of paragraph 43 cap A, that disposal isn't one that gives you proceeds. So if you look at the first example we spoke, you said, listen, what the extraordinary dividend will represent, proceeds.
Yeah.
In other words, in that 100 million example, the first one, let's say we had 50 million rands with base cost, we can still offset our 50 million rands base cost. If we fall within the subscription example that you've mentioned now, the extraordinary dividend comes the capital gain.
Sure.
And so you can't offset your base cost. And that's particularly challenging for people.
Mm.
And it happens oftentimes where, in the context where you want to empower key shareholders, but you want to make the price cheaper for them.
Exactly.
But ring fencing some of the value for yourself. And it sort of inadvertently triggers it.
And that's also a scary topic, and we're not going to touch on it, but key shareholders are usually employees. So if you start bringing in reduced prices for that, then you start falling in Section 8C. It's not one of the provisions or sections we're going to talk about today. But that's also a crucial concept, is always make sure you're doing transactions at value.
Yeah, I think what's the common denominator about these transactions is that they try to attack specific transactions about all of these provisions. They're trying to attack specific transactions. But what ends up happening sometimes is they catch transactions that I'm not always sure they're intended to catch, but people inadvertently fall into them.
Yeah.
And, you know, 8C is another one. People oftentimes mistake the complexity of it. We should definitely have a discussion on 8C at some other stage.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's a prevalent point at the end of the day.
Exactly. But if you take now our 43 cap A example, the intention isn't really necessarily to sell. It's to ring fence some of the value for ourselves.
Yes.
But it does get caught in the 43 cap A scenario because it views it as a disposal. Now, there are arguments for and against why, you know, policy-wise, why you should do that. But it shows you people think that, oh, we'll just do it as a dividend and a subscription. It's not a buyback and a subscription. It's a dividend and a subscription. Still caught.
Still caught. Thank you for that. I think that is incredible insight into understanding paragraph 43A. And for the listeners, I hope they understand. Listen, it's something to think about.
It's something to consider. We need to understand the transaction. And in a future episode, me and you, we're going to discuss the importance of having the right advisors and people that understand these sections, the Tax Act, how it links into in one of our other episodes we're going to do on simulation, how all of these things are actually all tied in together.
In this specific context, I would advise that if you're dealing with a scenario where there's been a dividend and you either have some form of a subscription or there's some form of a sale, just speak to it.
So yeah.
Get in touch with someone for, even if it's just for half an hour, to assess, you know, are you in the green, orange, or red scenario?
Absolutely. Thank you for that. I think that is incredible. If we jump over to our next specific anti-avoidance, Section 8E, Hybrid Equity Instruments. Now, this is one of those sections in the Act that I am particularly afraid of. I don't like it. I try to stay as far as possible away from 8E. I know in certain instances, it's worthwhile to be there. But for our listeners, can you explain high level, what is a hybrid equity instrument? What is Section 8E?
Effectively, what Section 8E tries to do is it tries to recategorize. We're again in the dividends.
The dividend sphere.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It tries to recategorize dividends that would usually be exempt for the shareholder to the form of taxable interest.
Yeah.
And what it does is it says, look, the mechanism with which you have funded this company is deemed, you say, it's a share in the company. But it looks to us like debt. It smells to us like debt. We're going to treat it as debt.
Yeah.
And the obvious disadvantage, of course, is if it was a debt instrument, the proceeds that you receive from it or the return that you get on your instrument is interest.
Absolutely.
Taxable. Yeah. Whereas if you can structure it in the form of dividends, then it becomes, again, exempt, non-taxable. Yeah. So why would people do that? You often see this, or used to at least, happen in scenarios where you have some form of a startup company that has got significant losses, at least for the initial period. They need startup funding to get this business, you know, sort of off the ground. And it's probably going to take between 5 or 10 years before they start actually making taxable profits. So
to speak.
And they're not so interested in the deduction. Of course, the dividends, if structured in the form of dividend, the company receiving the funding doesn't get a deduction. But they're not so interested in getting a deduction because they have sufficient other expenses that effectively allow them to not have to worry about tax
for a while.
Exactly, yeah. The person giving funding, they are more interested in receiving exempt funding. They don't want interest. Exactly. They want dividends. And so what typically happens is they structure it in such a way to ensure that, you know, what they receive is actually dividends while they hold the benefit of sort of a debt-like type instrument.
Okay.
And I think that's the part where 8E becomes really relevant. Yeah. Again, we'll probably talk about it in a moment about some places where 8E inadvertently triggers people.
Exactly.
And
before we get there, can you give me a few red flags, if you can, in terms of if you see a specific share class or share rights or something that the listeners can look out for and say, listen, this makes it look and smell like a debt instrument and not anymore like a equity instrument.
So what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to just in a general sense talk through the requirements for it to be a hybrid equity instrument. Because it's the moment that you're a hybrid equity instrument that 8E becomes very relevant. I think broadly speaking, there are three things that you need to look out for.
Yeah.
The first is if you have a preference share. So a preference share is defined in Section 8EA, and that is either shares that are not equity shares. So any shares that aren't equity shares are automatically preference shares. Or if there are equity shares, if their dividend rights is determined in relation to the time value of money, some form of interest rate metric, so to speak.
I think just before we continue on that, I think it's important for the listeners to also understand, because we spoke about equity shares and preference shares.
Yeah.
So if it's, what is an equity share? So if, I don't know if you want to quickly comment on the definition on an equity share and how do you classify as an equity share, not a preference share?
It's also, it can get highly technical, but just sort of bird's eye view on an equity share. An equity share is any share that is unrestricted, either in respect of dividends or in respect of its capital rights.
Okay, so that means I can restrict one of them, but not both of them.
Exactly. Most importantly, the restriction needs to be to a specified amount.
Yeah.
And that's where the technicality comes in. Because sometimes you have shares that are restricted, but they're not necessarily restricted to a specified amount. And therefore, they still do qualify as equity shares.
Mm.
Now, that's the distinction on equity shares.
Okay.
In a nutshell.
Perfect.
So if you don't have a preference share, so preference share, what would a typical type of preference share look like? Well, a typical type of preference share would be one where you say, I subscribe for 100 Rand and the dividends that I receive is 8%.
Based on prime or whatever.
Exactly. Either a fixed amount, you say, 6%, mm-hmm. or you link it to some form of a time value of money metric, interest rate yeah. metric, etc. That's a typical, what would typically be a preference share. Now, it gets technical because for it to then be a, it's not enough for it to be a preference share, to be a liquid instrument, still be secured by another financial instrument.
Yeah.
I think it gets technical beyond the means of this podcast. But if you have a share like that, you should raise your eyebrows.
Absolutely.
I think that's the point.
That's the point, yeah.
The second then is sort of both, they just work both ways, is where if you have, if either the issuer or the receiver of the share has the ability to redeem that share in a period of 3 years.
Okay.
But importantly, that's how you'd usually describe it, like I did now. Mm. Say if you have the ability to redeem the share. Now, it's not, the act is a little bit more specific like that. It's to redeem the share or to redeem any portion of the share, the initial subscription price. So let's say I subscribe for 100 Rand, but we've got the ability to redeem 10 Rand of my 100 Rand in a year's time, potentially. That is potentially a share that's going to fall within the hybrid equity instrument scenario. People will say, but I don't have the obligation to redeem the share. It's not about redeeming the share.
Yeah.
It's about redeeming it. It can still be a hybrid equity instrument, even if just a portion of that subscription price is effectively. And so it's either if the holder or the issuer of that share has that type of right. And then there's a last category, which is a very wide category, which is where people get very clever and they link types of equity, what's termed equity instruments with similar type rights. It's effectively a catch-all.
Yeah.
If you have any instrument, contractual or share-like, that contain these elements, you should consider getting it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is incredible insight into understanding 8E. Although it's a very complex topic, it's not necessarily something you're going to discuss over a braai and a beer at the end of the day.
Or we might.
But for the everyday business owner, it's purely something just to consider. If someone offers you as a complex structure or anything like that, it's necessary, it's important to have a look, discuss with an educated and a professional, someone like myself, someone like Bobby, someone that works with these type of things on a daily basis. And let's stay up to date with the specific provisions that change quite regularly in the tax at the end of the day.
Absolutely. And like 8E has been, you'll see now, Namibia, our country next door, our neighbors, they're introducing 8E first. And I suspect it's going to take a while before they have provisions that are similar. They may just copycat our provisions.
Which they usually do to a certain extent.
Exactly. Exactly. But 8E has taken us quite a significant amount of time to develop. And it keeps on developing. And I see now it slipped in the last budget that Treasury is again going to play with this idea of a preference share in 8E. I don't know what it's going to look like. We'll probably see when the bills come out sometime in the next month, 6 weeks.
Yeah.
But still being tinkered, sort of adjusted to account for what Treasury sees as.
I think on the almost the last point to discuss on both of these, both paragraph 43A and section 8E, the fact is both of them are anti-avoidance. Now, how I've been taught and how I grew up in this world is wherever there's anything to do with anti-avoidance, focus on documentation. Focus on getting your commercials in place. Make sure it's a commercial transaction. At the end of the day, it's not a tax transaction. We're not doing anything for tax. It's a commercial transaction. We just make sure we're not inefficient with tax at the end of the day.
I've seen it so many times. Transactions that don't intend to be in one form are actually then classified in that form because the documentation is not properly set up.
Absolutely.
You know, a clause in an agreement like, 10% must be redeemed. Given the obligation to redeem within a period of time, within less than 3 years. It's put in there nonchalantly and all of a sudden it characterizes all your dividends, your entire instrument, hybrid equity instrument.
Absolutely.
Just not given careful enough thought. If you told the parties that this would be the content, they said that's not at all what we intended. Scrap that provision completely. We don't need that.
Yeah.
But it just gets thrown in there. It's a deal sweetener. got to be very careful of those types of scenarios.
Absolutely. Very, very important. Bobby, on a last point, what would be your key takeaways for, from these two specific anti-avoidance sections? If you had to shorten just nuggets for the listeners to say, listen, okay, these are short things that I can just remember to make sure that I'm always on the right side of paragraph 43A and 8E.
I think the easiest way is whenever you have any transaction where the bulk of your proceeds is going to be in the form of big same dividends, make sure you speak to an advisor.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the complexities that we spoke about now today, people may forget, might not remember, maybe they'll remember a small nugget here or there. But I think if they if people forget everything, just remember wherever you have transactions where the bulk of your proceeds is going to be in the form of big same dividends, check it with an advisor. Make sure that everything is above board and that you don't trip up.
That is absolutely fantastic advice. And that's a wrap. Thank you very much for joining Advisory Explained. Bobby Wessels, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure. It's been an honor. And on to the next. We're going to do a few episodes with Bobby over the course of the next few weeks to discuss very specific, very timeous topics such as GAR, simulation. We're going to touch on tax opinions, the importance of tax opinions. And I know a lot of people just see it as an extra cost. I see it as almost your Bible for your transaction that you're doing at the end of the day. So yes, thank you very much. And until next time.
Thanks, Chrissy.